Anthony Wilson has published 3 collections of poetry and held a number of poetry residencies, including at Tate Britain, the Poetry Society, and the Times Educational Supplement. His latest book, Love for Now, is his journal of being diagnosed with lymphoma in 2006 at the age of 42. Would you join me in giving a warm Greenbelt welcome to Anthony Wilson?
Thank you. Thanks for being here. I think it's a tough sell. Two tough sells, poetry and cancer. And I was invited to be at the festival, we just thought we'd go for a direct title in the programme, you know, Life Begins with Cancer, so that everyone would know what this was about. So, I, as you've heard, I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was 42. I'm going to be talking and reading about that experience, so I'm not going to be reading from any of my other books this evening, so this is the topic, this is the subject we're encountering, just so you're clear about that. And before I begin reading from my two books, I'll just tell you a bit of the story to contextualise what happened. So you know, usually I would go straight in with the poem, but I think, you know, because of the topic, I think it's just important you know some things about what occurred. So on January the 1st, 2006, New Year's Day 2006, I woke up with a very sharp pain in my right hand side, right here. And you know, we'd been out the night before, we'd been celebrating with friends, it was a very nice evening. As you can imagine, we got home pretty late, slept in as you do, woke up, and yet there was this pain. And you know, I was saying, I just don't feel this is, you know. And there was not a great deal of sympathy in the house on January the 1st, 2006. You're the worst for wear and so on, and I wasn't actually, for the record. But the pain got worse. By the end of that evening, we were in accident and emergency, trying to get, you know, because nothing took the edge of, you know, paracetamol and so on. So we were in accident and emergency in Exeter. I remember we got turfed out halfway through because one of the fire alarms went off by mistake, and there were all these people in, you know, in wheelchairs and, you know, rugs and stuff, and it was just the most surreal experience. And the young doctors there, they didn't know what was wrong. They couldn't, you know, because they said, look, if you had initially, because of the pain being here, they said, well, look, if it was kidney stones, you'd be rolling around on the floor, literally rolling around on the floor. It's not kidney stones. They were absolutely sure of that, but they didn't really know. So off we went with more painkillers and and that led to some tests. And by the end of that week, I was hospitalized. My GP said, you need to go to hospital. And he ran a little blood test, which indicated that something wasn't quite right, without really saying what he thought at that point. The people in the emergency medical unit, where I spent a couple of nights, they didn't really know what was going on. So I went back again with yet even stronger painkillers. And still the pain wasn't really going away. So after, it's kind of really long story short, but you'll hear quite a lot of it. My GP eventually said, I think you need to go and have an ultrasound. And so I had an ultrasound, you know, like a baby scan. They found what they call an abnormality. They don't use the word tumour at that point, but they found, which subsequently was found to be my tumour, actually here, not here. So it was referred pain, pressing against all the tubes and nerve endings in that part of my body. And then they obviously did a biopsy of that, and they found it was large B-cell diffuse non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a blood cancer. It's a cancer of the lymphatic system. So that's my story, and I'm going to read to you from two books, a book of poems called Riddance and a book of memoir, or journal, really, because this is my journal, Love for Now, which I wrote as I was going along. I just want to say one very brief thing about Riddance. The poems were all written, all of them were written after I got better. So what you get in the diary is like minute by minute, this is what I'm going through, but the poems are all written subsequently, and that's just important for you to know. I'm going to start with a poem of direct address. By that I mean a poem where I'm talking to the thing that's inside my body, as though, you know, this is a very long tradition in English literature, like Shelley talking to autumn, or a Grecian urn, or you know, sorry, Keats talking to a Grecian urn, or Shelley talking to the western wind. So I'm just talking to my tumour as though it was a person. There's two references in this poem which you just need to know. One is Grover Washington Jr., American saxophonist, and the indie band This Mortal Coil, appropriately enough. Tumour. You gave me time to notice. Apple blossom, hand movements, the light taking leave of rooms. I would like to claim new attention to my children, but the truth is they grew up whether I watched them or not. Mostly I slept. You began in midsummer. It took till February to find you. By then all I knew were symptoms, insomnia, night sweats, a cough I could not shake off. Because of you, I revisited old LPs. I did not want to die not having fried onions to Grover, made bubbles to This Mortal Coil. The script writers of Frasier helped me recover from you, plus condensed milk and broccoli, but not at the same time. Eventually, I drank coffee again. You reacquainted me with my guilt. The way I glared at S after she'd poured out her heart in the autumn of endless nights with nothing but the wind for company. I chose songs having you and invented ceremonies by rivers. But I found no poetry in you. You saved me from talking about house prices. You obliterated my craving for alcohol. I would say I am grateful, but I'm not ready for that just yet. One of the themes in both of these books, which I go back to and back to and back to, is the theme of the language we use generally in our culture to discuss cancer. I've become a little bit obsessed by it, I think, and I certainly became very interested in it while I was being treated. And one thing in particular irks me very strongly about this, which is the way we tend to fall back on martial or war metaphor, but the metaphor of the battle, to describe people's experience of cancer. So you will all be aware of things you will have heard this year already, when a sports person or a celebrity has died after a short battle or sometimes a long battle with cancer. And that's the way we tend to go in our culture. I think that's not helpful for three reasons. I think it puts, first of all, when you're undergoing chemotherapy or having radiotherapy, you feel the battle is being done to you on that level. I think the second reason is that it romanticizes the disease, like it's your responsibility as a patient to get better. And thirdly, it kind of cuts the populace into two camps, if you like. You either win or you lose, and none of us want to be on the losing side in this particular so-called battle. So my way of dealing with this one of the ways that I've written about it is in this very simple poem where I play with the idea of fighting the disease, and it's called I Am Fighting. A very simple form that I'm using, which you'll all pick up very quickly. I am fighting. I am fighting. We are talking in a room across a table. You are waiting. I am fighting down a corridor in an armchair. You are reading in a ward across the bed where I am fighting. I am sleeping, imagining, dreaming, flying, running. I am fighting. I am waking, stretching, yawning. On the sofa, you are crying. We are walking through a doorway. I am sitting, now I'm lying. I am sleeping, you are sitting. We are waiting. I am fighting. I'm going to read the very first bit of this book, Love For Now, which is the bit I began writing it about a week before I was diagnosed formally. I was diagnosed formally on Valentine's Day in 2006. So I began writing about a week before that. So this is me sitting at the kitchen table on the 7th of February in 2006, and this is where we go straight into the action. Is there a moment when you know? From my ultrasound to my biopsy took just 11 days. It was when the scan doctor said I would need a CT scan in 2 weeks, and they made an appointment the same evening for me to have one 48 hours later. I got really worried. The CT was a Thursday. They said, you'll know the results in 2 weeks. But my GP phoned the next morning asking to see me. This was even worse. Tatty took that day off so we could see him together. He said, if this abnormality hadn't been pressing on your urethra and therefore giving you pain, we may have never known about it. It's a blessing, really. He confirmed that it was indeed solid, not a polyp or a cyst, and on my lymph nodes. I asked him directly if there was a possibility that it was lymphoma, and for the first time he looked away slightly before saying yes, that he couldn't rule that possibility out. I'm at home now, propped up on the bed. Officially, I won't know for sure for another 10 or 12 days, but right there, in the GP's face and in the way he reached for an envelope to send my notes in with me to hospital, there was a tensing and a reluctance and a pursing of the lips, the merest hint of a nod, and that was when I knew. At the same time, I know nothing, of course. All to play for, not even half time, plenty left in the tank. It might be completely benign, you know, probably is, as a friend said on the weekend. This is well-meaning, but bollocks, intended to reassure them more than me. The first discussion with the senior staff registrar of the emergency medical unit said it all too, but in a different way. Her name is Esther. She's smiley, hair up at the back, glasses, trace of a Northern Irish or Northern Irish Scots accent. She has pink, chubby fingers and puts her hand out to touch me a lot on my forearm and on my shoulder. She began asking me what I knew. She stopped me 2 words in when I said tumour. Well, we don't know that yet. I think we just have to say abnormality for now. We must do until we know more. Right, well, this abnormality then is on my... I paused, looking at her for reassurance. She nodded, knowing I was going to say lymph nodes. And it's pressing on my kidneys, hence the pain. She beamed. That's right, yes. It's actually the tube coming out of your kidneys, your urethra. But yes, that's why you're in pain. Tatty said, and it is solid, isn't it? We'd been told to ask this by a medical friend. Liquid usually means safe, solid means bad. The smile fell from her face. Yes, as far as we can tell, it is yes. She smiled again. But for now, we'll run a few tests, then go from there. She touched my arm. Is that all right? Of course, absolutely. In a minute, I'll have to examine you. I hope you don't mind me asking, but has your GP mentioned your testicles at all? Tatty and I glanced at each other. It's long been a private joke between us that whenever I go to the doctors, it's always my balls they end up looking at. I've had this feeling since I was 6. One of the things that I just think is really, I've been already alluded to this topic, this really enormous topic of language about cancer and disease. I think it's really difficult for both the person who has the cancer and the people around the person who has cancer, whether it's family or friend or church family or whatever. I just think it is difficult. I don't think there's a particular answer to this, so I'm not sure I really have an answer, and we might get into this in the questions later. But I think that, you know, there are days as a cancer patient when you want it always, when you want someone to come in and just, you know, really tune into how you're feeling without you having to say anything. There are days when it's absolutely the thing you want to do, which is only talk about your cancer. And there are also days when the only thing you want to talk about is, you know, anything but, like the football or what you were watching on telly. And so it's very hard to get it right. And I just acknowledge that, you know, from both sides. I think it's just very hard. And I think for those of us who are around people with cancer, I think my chief advice would be to say, take your lead from the person that you're with. And this applies to, you know, how we pray for people who are ill too. Having said that, this is a poem that sort of tackles that subject head on. So it's called How to Pray for the Dying. How to Pray for the Dying. Do not say, Lord, this is not of you, rebuking our tumours as though we were not in the room with them. Say instead, we are afraid and we do not understand. Think of it as a window misted with sighs, not an arm wrestle with God who sees your thoughts from afar. Pray in tongues by all means, but also remember our kids. Pray that we sleep. Pray for the obvious. Pray we live to see Christmas. Don't you dare say, it's not fair. Spare me your weeping. Try saying, shit happens. You're very kind. I know this is tough stuff to hear. And don't feel you have to. This is a little further into the journal, the memoir. I've already had chemotherapy by now, the point where I'm about to read this. And what I found myself wanting was, you are bombarded. Some of you I know this, but you are just bombarded with literature and things to look at on the internet. And of course, you can't take it all in, you know, it's just, you can't. But what I found myself wanting was a leaflet which would precisely describe the exact thing that I was going through, not just that you'll feel sick and lose your hair and so on, which I kind of already knew. I wanted a leaflet which said this, and so not having that leaflet doesn't exist. I've written it here in the book. I think what you want is a list which takes you through what you feel. Something aligns along the lines of this. The first day of treatment, you're going to throw up in the evening because, let's face it, you're full of poison and you will lie down too quickly, not having been told that to do so brings on the nausea very forcefully, and that staying upright is your best bet. The next morning, you're going to feel sick again, but won't be. Instead, you'll notice how something like a nuclear reaction seems to be going on below your diaphragm. You'll carry your sick bucket around the house with you, sit near the loo for long periods, and walk close to hedges when you leave the house. You will pee almost constantly. If you remember to drink fluids as we encouraged you, it will run clear. If you forget, your pee will look like Pinot Noir and stink like a sewer. This is normal. You will lie awake at night and wake up fully at hours previously known to you through baby care. You will notice the dark and the cold, your thoughts clanking in your head as they pace through your skull. You will get up for one more pee, only to throw in the towel at 5:02, sitting in the kitchen, leafing through old copies of the Express and Echo, convinced you recognise the photograph of the child on page 3. You will take 20 minutes to down all your drugs. It is not the swallowing you find hard, just the sheer quantity. You like them best with chocolate milk, then a banana, then some dried apricots, then some toast, then some Marmite on the knife. You notice you have not been making any bowel movements. You eat more dried apricots, more toast. You leave it a day and find you go twice either side of lunch, which is baked beans on toast plus extra toast with bread and butter while you wait for them to cook. You find you have limitless energy, the kind which sends you into town to the library and considering buying coffee. You smile a lot, especially at the school gate. The nuclear reaction seems to be dying down a bit. You go out for a pizza. You try a tiny sip of wine over supper. You wake with an axe through your head. This goes on all week, except you skip the wine. You call the hospital. They tell you this is normal. Just when you are used to things, it hits you like a wave or a sudden gust from behind a street corner. Fatigue is in everything you do. You lift your head from the pillow and it hurts. You notice your slippers make little scraping noises as you shuffle from room to room. You stay in one room, near the telly. You give thanks for the remote control. The phone rings. You do not answer it, even though it is 6 inches from the bed, across the bed from you. You start to sleep for hours, waking from dreams about playing team sports at school as a teenager. But you crave sleep. You think you look good curled up. And then the shivers start. Somewhere in your back, above your kidneys, a tense pulse that begins warmly and ends in a shudder near your spine throws long electrical currents. You think of an octopus, a giant squid. You think of Doctor Who. You think of Fawlty Towers. What would you give to be watching it for the first time with your father, scarcely able to believe your luck, your luminous happiness? And then it goes. It comes back when you cook the children their supper. It is one of your best sauces ever, and you are bent double. You notice you've run out of pepper. You think about ringing the hospital. While the children eat, they joke and argue warily. You tell them it's nothing. You go back to feeling merely exhausted. It has snowed outside. The government have won a vote. England are back in the test. You know you will survive. So I said that this book, Riddance, is a book I wrote entirely after I was told I was better and the treatment had finished. And I mentioned in my first poem that I was unable to, I didn't really have any kind of capacity for either reading or writing poetry. I found no poetry in you. I absolutely just couldn't pick up a poetry book, and that was really distressing to me. When I was being treated, I found I could write prose and I could just about read the sports pages, but concentrating on anything more was very hard. And I did once I was better, I did sort of begin consciously, because I know that there'd been all this experience that had happened to me. I began consciously searching for and, as it were, experimenting with and trying out metaphors for what I've been going through that weren't the battle metaphor, as I've been saying. So I'm going to read two poems now, which are about that. And the first one is, I'm just going to contextualise just by saying that I'm a great fan and admirer of the work of a British poet, but who spent most of his adult life in California, a man called Tom Gunn, who's sadly no longer with us, published by Faber and Faber, who wrote the most incredible book, called The Man with Night Sweats. Now that book is a book of poems cataloguing what happened to his community in San Francisco vis-a-vis the AIDS epidemic in the 80s and 90s. It's a very controlled book, and yet it's full of rage and emotion. And he writes in these very tightly rhyming, highly syllabic forms, you know, with a certain number of syllables per line. And I've always really thought that was just an incredible book, and I was aware of it, again, while I was being treated, partly because lymphoma, what I had, shares in common with AIDS. One thing that I knew about, which is the thing about night sweats. I knew that people with AIDS often, but not always, but often have those night sweats. I had that too, a little bit. And one thing that I didn't know, which is that often in the final stages of AIDS, but not exclusively to all people with AIDS, but sometimes lymphoma is the thing that actually finally kills that particular person, not in all cases. And so this just felt like a sort of, like lots of things coming together at once. So I wanted to kind of, in a way, sort of acknowledge that sort of debt to what Tom Gunn has done in his book, but also try and reconfigure my own story. So I've borrowed one of the form that he uses in the book, the title poem of his book, The Man with Night Sweats, and this is my response to it, and I've called it On Rereading The Man with Night Sweats. Today is Valentine's. Later, they will tell me what I know in my bones. It will not be pretty. Shivering and soaked through, I'm put in mind of you, pacing the floor at dawn, listening for avalanche in sinew and in skin, which do not seem to change. And yet, you know full well how skin feels when it melts, the sabotage of cells destroying their good host while dining out in hell. Our plagues are cousins, ghost. The curse within our blood can never be proved good. Your rhymes dare me to dream not of eternal life, that things aren't what they seem, of living in the light long enough to be brave. May it never arrive. And this story, which I'm assuming, I'm making an assumption here, will be familiar to all of us in this room, a story from Luke's Gospel, where we read that Jesus was walking along and was confronted and met by 10 men, we understand, we don't know, but men with leprosy, and he heals them. And we also read that one of them comes back to say thank you. I've always found that a really arresting story. It's got so many layers of unexplained stuff. And so, again, sort of kind of making a connection between AIDS and leprosy again, but also my own experience. Jesus heals 10 lepers. We miss just about everything. An AIDS ward doesn't come close. Or even an oncology unit with its scarf-headed, goitered women and men with purple necks. Think of a family tree. There's a blank where your name resided. The no-go area of town, that's home. You despise those you live with, the stumpy, whitening flesh, the stink of rot they can't feel. Don't even think of community. This was evidence of sin, yours or the mother who disowned you, who in any case was known as a whore. Even the healing command is cruel, a joke, surely, pre-Python, show yourselves to the priest. You can imagine how the returner felt. He must have gripped Jesus' ankles till they bled. You would think he couldn't wait to leave. One of the things which I is not true for everyone who has my story, but it's just true for me because it happened, and I'll never really understand what happened. No one really knows, actually. Is that halfway through my treatment for this cancer, I was told that I was relapsing. So I'd had quite a lot of chemotherapy by this stage, and the doctors were really happy with how things were going. You know, obviously it was tough on me, but you know, they said it was great. And we think what happened is that a radiologist, so no one I knew, no one I was coming into contact with, we think what happened is that they looked at my scan results the wrong way around. So we think what happened is that they saw scan B and then scan A, and instead of my tumour going from big to small, they saw it going from small to big. And so they booked in a whole new different line of chemotherapy treatment, which is even more aggressive than the one I was on. And you know, this was all about to happen, and it, you know, then they discovered the mistake just in time. But this is the bit of the diary of the moment when they find out, you know, and we get told the news and we go into the room and it's all. I should just say that one contextualizing bit of knowledge, my ward doctor, who sadly is no longer with us, an amazing person, who in the book I call Carl, it was well known on the ward, it's not a secret, he himself had Hodgkin's lymphoma, slightly different from my own cancer, but a blood cancer nevertheless. He'd had that most of his adult life, and we talk about this in this little bit. So it was a well-known thing. And that's part of the bit I'm about to read as well. So this occurs in April 2006. Yesterday was the worst day so far. Not the chemo, which I am sailing through, but the news after it. After an early finish, say 2:30, Carl, ushered us into consulting room 2, where Felicity Carr, that was my consultant, and Carol, the research nurse, sat. There was a gloomy atmosphere, in spite of Felicity's determined and natural sparkliness. She began talking before we even sat down. It's not good news, I'm afraid. The news from the scan. Far from shrinking, your tumour appears to have grown. I can't tell you how disappointed we are. She outlined immediately what the next steps will be. I'm about to leave R-CHOP, that's the regime I was on, in favour of ESHAP, an even more aggressive treatment, which will start on Thursday week. I'll have to go in tomorrow to have a Hickman line put in my chest, a device which allows the drugs to be pumped in intravenously and also at home. I'm to have 2 cycles of this, 4 weeks apart, and then a bone marrow transplant at the end. They're already talking about getting stem cells from me and about possible donors from my siblings. Felicity was lovely as ever, but extremely grave underneath it all. She said, "We're guilty, I suppose, for saying there were such high hopes at the beginning, but 80% are really good odds. I'm just so sorry that for you, for whatever reason, you've fallen into the unlucky 20%, for whom it doesn't work. We will, of course, review everything." She didn't give me any percentages this time. I asked her, of course, why they thought it hadn't worked. After a lot of scientific stuff about the rituximab not really having done its trick and killing the proteins on the tumour, she was left hypothesising, urgently flicking backwards and forwards in my file to the original histology report. I felt a bit gauche to have asked, but I felt I didn't really have a choice. Then I asked, no, ask away, it's so important, whether they could hypothesise about how long I'd had the disease, as this was the question I'd been asked most often by friends. Again, after a lot of scientific stuff about one cell receiving either genetic or radioactive information in order to start growing, she couldn't say. Carl piped in at this point and guessed at around 6 months, which means it began sometime last summer. Felicity asked Carol to make us some tea, and after a lot of reiterating the key facts, it will be worse than it has been so far and will take 4 to 6 months of further treatment. We got shown into the quiet room with its sofas, candles and soft lighting. We sat in there cuddling for a few minutes before Carl came in again and began chatting about his own cancer. He's had a relapse, he told us, and will be having to drive to Plymouth for radiology. My lymph nodes have just gone all over the place, he said. He looked utterly calm. Can I ask you about this? Sure. You've got Hodgkin's, right, which is rarer and less straightforward? Yeah, rarer, and my form's certainly less straightforward. How long have you had it? I'm 38 now. I was diagnosed at 16, and I'm still here. Shit. Absolutely. But as I said to you in the ward, when you told me you've been having pain, there's more than one way of skinning a cat. Did you know then? No, but my alarm bells were ringing. It shouldn't be happening. So you taper your language, you know, it's not over yet, and you've just got to realise you've been dealt a shit hand of cards, and that's what you've got to play with. Right. Shit happens, he said, not losing eye contact. That's one of our sayings, Tat said. By the way, she went on, this room is a disgusting colour. Good woman, he said. I've always thought it was a pile of crap from the day they painted it. My doctor, Carl, is something of a celebrity in Exeter, and I've written blogs about him, which then get enormous amounts of hits, because he was just a complete life force of nature, and a beautiful human being, and he did really speak like that, and I'm sure that, you know, well, one of my big regrets is that he didn't live to see my book. I'm going to read a little passage which is to do with what I think I learned. That's something that people have asked me a lot. You know, what does this mean? You know, I mean, in a sense, I can't really answer that. I don't know. But people asked me that when I was ill, and, you know, they still do. And it's hard to really quantify, you know, am I happy that it happened? Am I a different person? Yes, of course. You know, but would I have been the same person? I mean, there's so many things you just don't know. It's not science. But this is something I found myself writing one evening, much later in the process. This is about July time. So by this time, in the story, the relapse mistake, in quotes, has been uncovered. I'm back on the normal treatment again. I more or less know that it's going to work, but I'm not sure where it ends. I don't know where this thing ends. So I'm still uncertain. I don't know if I'm going to need radiotherapy, which I did need, but I didn't know that at the time when I wrote this. So it's full of questions still, but this is an attempt, just an attempt to try and say, this is what I want out of this. What I want is to be present. That's what I've learned. I want to strive for presence here, now, in my kitchen, with a Boeing overhead, and later a Morena's prize giving as she collects her award. In my writing, as I listen to the music in a line and as my characters cause each other damage, to hear it, feel it, and imagine it as one might, the shock of recognition of Thomas putting his hand in the Lord's side. I want that deep down sense of things, to use Hopkins' phrase. The wild cry of shame in Sheem's voice when he comes home in late and when we're not even angry with him. The laughter and a candlelit table which is both transitory and timeless. To spot words in Shakespeare plays you didn't even know he used, botched, for example. To watch weird dance and good meaty thrillers. To walk on Exmouth Beach on bracing Saturday afternoons and be rugby tackled by your son and his friend. To use trains. To watch the light take leave of a room. To breathe. And then breathe again. But to notice it. I'm going to read two more pieces, one more from Love For Now, one more poem, and then I think somewhere there is a roving microphone and, you know, we'll open it up for responses and questions and a bit of chat. You heard me just reading a moment ago about when did I get this. You know, I was sort of saying to my doctors, well, look, you know, now we know I'm relapsing, which is what we thought at the time. When did they think this this started? And again, you know, there's absolutely no one really knows. And you realise that, I began realising as this process went on, that quite a lot of the stuff that you get told when you go through this process of being treated is that the doctors don't know a lot. And that's not me being rude. They just actually, there was a brilliant moment shortly after the relapse episode, or the so-called relapse, where the doctors actually said, you know, in the end, this is more of a, or just as much rather, of an art or a craft as it is a science. And that was an absolute revelation to me. You know, I think like most people in the Western culture, I'd grown up with this sort of Enlightenment model of science is everything. And, you know, and you realise actually it doesn't tell you everything. And in a way that was, you know, frightening, but actually very reassuring at the same time. So again, this is my way of trying to play with that, you know, a little bit. When did I get this? Was it there on Christmas Day as I carved the turkey wearing my lovely stripy shirt that was given to me for my anniversary? Yes. Was it there when I played football 2 days after Christmas and got bollocked by Pug's friend Tristan because I was slow, useless, had no first touch and let in 3 quick goals? Yes. Was it there when I cooked chicken with lemon and olives for my students? Yes. Was it there when I struggled into work a week later feeling fluey and everyone said kindly how terrible I looked? Yes. It was there when I burned CDs from the library and it was there when I lit fireworks in the garden for the kids. It was there when I went to the dump with Sheem and it was there when Bendy and I shopped in the January sales. It was there at the Boston Tea Party over latte, and it was there at the family curry. It was there when I cycled to work, and it was there when I strolled round the quay. It was there when I emailed colleagues, and it was there when I sent apologies to meetings. It was there when I lectured students, and there when we met one to one. It was there in my initials, in their files. It was there when I went for bread, when I made love, bought cheese, scanned the sports pages, picked up a poetry book, posted a postcard, had my hair cut, made porridge, called the builder. It was there, uninvited and growing in the dark. I did not ask for it. I did not deserve it. It is not fair. But it found me, and I accepted it. Okay, the final poem, and this is I've deliberately put this one at the end because it's a poem about after, and it's in the final section of my book of poems, which is really about this uncertain territory, which in some ways you could say I'm still in. I have been in what they call full remission since the autumn of 2006, and that's a great thing. That is a really, really great thing. And so this poem is really not about cancer, but it is about borderline. It's about that sort of liminal territory that we go to. In this case, it's about an actual physical landscape. If you know Exeter and know Devon, you might know the River Exe estuary, which is the most magical place. It's probably my favourite place in Exeter. Exeter is one of those great places. It's quite tiny and you can walk out of it. And if you know where to start walking, you can basically carry on walking and eventually you just get to the estuary. It's just the most wonderful place. And this particular place is where you have a railway down on the valley floor. You also have the Exeter Ship Canal, England's oldest canal, and also the River Exe, which suddenly gets incredibly wide and flat. So Devon's quite a hilly place, but this bit is a really flat area. And you've got birds, white, lots of seagulls and stuff, and you've also got fields which are just full of ditches and everything's wet, and you can see Frisian cows eating, and then suddenly huge expanses of river. It's just the most amazing place. On this bit of land, you've got this lovely pub which is only open half the year called the Turf Hotel, and it sits on this spit of land which just juts out into the estuary. So I refer to that in the poem, the turf. And the other thing I just want to refer to briefly before I read you the poem and then we'll open it up is just an unusual word, the word kledge. Kledge is a word which just means the upper stratum of fibrous, humusy, undried clay. That's all that means, which you can see there. So the poem is, I just want to say before anything, before I read it, it's just really thank you for listening to this tough stuff. The poem's called Borderline. These are the flatlands, stitched between floodplain and ditch, everything provisional, ooze and sluice. The estuary looks walkable, spines of red clay rising from slate water with flanks of weeping slip, which shimmer, mother of pearl, silver, molten. A powerboat that was toy bounces through its roar, its wake slapping the kledge, scattering wagtails. The stranded barge of the turf breathes easy, its spur both tongue and poop deck. Beyond, a train becomes its horn, skeletal willows inch greener, and an oarsman pushes himself backwards into the future. Thank you very much.